It's amazing how even the simplest things in law, like a deadline, can get so complicated. You'd think it'd be straightforward, but then you dig into a case and realize, wow, there's a lot more to it.
Oh, absolutely. And today's case is a perfect example of that. We're going deep into United States v. Specter, a case from the First Circuit. And this one's particularly interesting for anyone studying law because it shows how ideas from contract law can pop up in criminal cases.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that makes you go, hold on, what? Like, those two areas don't usually mix, do they?
Well, you'd be surprised.
Oh.
So this case revolves around Michael Specter, who was being investigated by the Department of Labor. They were looking into whether he falsified documents related to an employee benefit plan, which could be violations of 18 U.S.C. sections 1 and 27 and 644.
Okay, so right off the bat, we're talking about some serious stuff. White-collar crime, federal statutes. This isn't some parking ticket dispute.
Right, definitely not. And of course, with any criminal case, there's a statute of limitations, a time limit for the government to bring charges. And in Specter's case, that deadline was fast approaching in early 1993.
So the pressure was on. What did Specter do?
Well, to avoid an immediate indictment, he chose to sign agreements with the government to extend that deadline. There were actually two of these agreements.
Two? Okay, let's take them one at a time. What was the first one about?
The first one was pretty standard. Both sides signed it, and it pushed the deadline out to March 8, 1993. No controversy there. Pretty common practice.
All right, that makes sense. But you said there was a second agreement.
There was, and this is where it gets really interesting. This second agreement was meant to extend the deadline even further, to April 16, 1993. Now, Specter and his lawyer, they both signed it, no problem.
But there's a but coming, isn't there?
There is. The government never signed this second agreement. It's completely missing their signature.
So essentially, they had an agreement on paper, but one side didn't fully commit to it. And I bet the timing of all this is crucial, right?
You bet it is.
Yeah.
The government ended up indicting Specter after that first extension had already expired, but before the date in that second unsigned agreement. So they were acting outside that initial time frame they had agreed to.
Yeah, that sounds like a bit of a legal loophole they were trying to exploit. And I'm guessing Specter's lawyers didn't just let that slide, did they?
They did not. They argued that the second extension, the one without the government's signature, wasn't valid. And because of that, the indictment was filed too late. And you know what? The district court actually agreed with them. They dismissed two of the counts against Specter, saying they were time barred. That's a pretty big win for the defense right there.
It is. It shows how crucial these procedural details can be, especially when you're talking about something as serious as an indictment. But this wasn't the end of the story, was it?
It wasn't. The government appealed, and the case went up to the First Circuit. And this is where the really fascinating legal question comes in. Does an unsigned waiver of the statute of limitations actually bind the defendant? The First Circuit had to figure that out, and their answer was a resounding no.
Okay, so they sided with Specter in the end, but their reasoning must have been interesting given how they tied contract law into all this. How did they get there?
Well, the First Circuit drew a parallel to contract law. They said, look, even though you don't always need that traditional consideration for a defendant to waive their statute of limitations defense, you know, that exchange is something valuable between both parties. The specific terms outlined in the agreements still matter. They matter a lot.
So it's not just about Specter getting something in return for extending the deadline. It's about everyone playing by the rules they agreed to in writing.
Exactly. Both agreements clearly stated that for the waiver to be valid, all parties had to sign. The government missed that step. They didn't sign that second agreement, and that made it unenforceable.
So even though the government's goal was to prosecute Specter, they kind of tripped themselves up by not following their own procedure?
You could say that. And the court really drove home this point about sticking to those written terms. Judge Campbell even said, and I quote, "Where the parties deliberately set forth conditions for effectiveness, courts shouldn't condone deviations." That's pretty strong language.
It is, and it really emphasizes how important it is for everyone to follow the agreed-upon rules. Otherwise, it creates uncertainty and can undermine the whole legal process.
Absolutely. And you made a really insightful point earlier about the First Circuit assuming contract principles applied here without explicitly saying they always apply in these situations. That's something law students should really pay attention to because it shows how different areas of law can influence each other without formally merging.
Yeah, it's like they're borrowing ideas from one area to solve a problem in another. That's pretty cool when you think about it.
It really is. It raises the question, what are those core principles that make an agreement enforceable no matter what area of law you're dealing with? In this case, the court really focused on honoring what the parties clearly intended as laid out in those agreements.
Okay, so we've walked through the details of the case and how the court reasoned through it, but let's step back and look at the bigger picture. What does United States v. Specter really mean for the legal world? Why should this case still matter to lawyers and law students today?
Well, this case definitively says that the statute of limitations isn't some impenetrable wall that automatically protects someone from prosecution after a certain time. It's a defense that can be waived, and defendants can actually negotiate to extend that deadline if they choose to. But, and this is a crucial point, the government has to play by the rules too. They can't just ignore the terms they agreed to, those agreements.
So it's a two-way street. Both sides have responsibilities and have to honor the agreements they make.
Precisely. And for anyone training to be a lawyer, the practical takeaway here is crystal clear. If you're drafting a legal agreement and it says all parties need to sign for it to be effective, you absolutely must get all those signatures. No exceptions. This case shows what a mess can happen and how much trust can be lost if you overlook a detail like that. Imagine if the government could just ignore the rules they set in agreements with defendants.
That's a scary thought. And it highlights how important precision is in law. It's not just about being neat and tidy. It's about making sure everything is done correctly and according to the rules.
Right, and the court made that point very clear. They said, deviating from explicit terms undermines certainty. And that's a powerful message for everyone in the legal profession. Whether it's a big, complicated contract or a seemingly simple waiver, the words matter and the conditions have to be met. There are real consequences if they're not.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up this deep dive into United States v. Specter, it's clear that getting those agreements fully executed with all the necessary signatures is absolutely vital, especially when we're talking about legal deadlines and criminal cases. Something as simple as getting a signature can be the difference between an agreement being rock solid or falling apart completely.
And as you continue your legal studies, think about this. This idea of sticking to the terms of an agreement, especially about signatures and conditions, how does that apply in other areas of law? We focused on criminal procedure here, but where else could failing to get those signatures or meet those conditions cause major problems? It's something to really consider.
It is. A lot of food for thought. Well, we hope this deep dive has shed some light on how different areas of law can intersect and why paying attention to the details is so essential in the legal world. Until next time, keep that legal curiosity burning bright.